themselves. "What seems to be the problem?" asked Sayakusi. "Can't do whatever it is without sacrificing babies?" he asked curiously.
"That would be one way to do it," admitted Penny, "but it wouldn't be my first choice."
"Then what?" Kusi asked insistently. Penny and I looked at each other, a long and searching look. Yes, that's what she was thinking. I heaved a great sigh. This was going to take some serious explanation.
Chapter 14. A Plan to Escape.
"Now tell me again how nailing your old girlfriend is going to save all our lives," asked Alia, with a sarcastic toss of her head.
There was a blaze behind her eyes that made me uncomfortable. Hell, it scared me. I'd rather fight a squad of black skulls than face a wronged woman. "It has to do with the nature of magical power," I tried to explain for the fourth or fifth time. "In order to open one of these portals, you need a truly massive amount of energy, properly tuned and augmented, more than even a highly trained group of magi could generate on their own."
"But you have witch stones," she said angrily. "I thought..."
"The Irionite gives us a way of amplifying that power, certainly. I wouldn't even make the attempt without it. But even when we are using the stones, they are not exactly producing arcane energy, merely amplifying the energy we send through them. If we want to open this portal and keep it open long enough to do any good, then it will require every shred of power that we can muster, and iron control over that power, tuned properly and directed with incredible precision. Now, I could lecture you for hours about the various ways to raise power. Drugs can be used, when you have the right ones in the right dosage and you know what you are doing. Chanting works, if you have a few weeks and a devout enough group who likewise knows what they are doing, and we just don't have the time for that. A lot of tribes use dancing, but that takes years of practice to do effectively.
I don't really see you as much of a dancer, she said.
I didn't know if she was trying to be mean or humorous or both. You'd be surprised.
No.
There are only two ways that I know of to generate a tremendous amount of raw arcane power in a short period of time. Blood sacrifice works terrifically well, and is possibly how the Gathani who found this cave did it at first. But I don't see anyone volunteering, and to be honest, I'm just not the kind of mage that can handle the ethical questions involved. Never mind the fact that it's been banned since Imperial times. Death magic is a potent and dangerous realm, but it's one way to achieve our means. The other is by tapping into the opposite realm, the realm of creation and procreation, from the sacred fount of life itself. Enormous amounts of power are available there, if you know how to capture it and make use of it. Every time a baby is born, there is a powerful release of arcane energy from that side of things, and occasionally it can manifest magically. I suppose if we had a few dozen pregnant women who could all go into labor at once, that might work. But there aren't that many here, and trying to arrange that kind of timing is just impractical.
So that leaves banging your old girlfriend. I'm starting to favor human sacrifice.
Well, yes. Sex magic pulls the same kind of power, but it's a lot easier to arrange and maintain. And sexual magic has other advantages as well, I said, as enthusiastically as I could. It can be sustained over time, whereas blood sacrifice is over pretty quickly. It doesn't leave a stain on the other world, the way sacrifice does, or birth, for that matter. You have a lot more control over it. It can be more gently manipulated, making it easier to focus into the proper sphere. And luckily, Pentandra has spent most of her professional career studying that particular branch of the art. She's probably the world's foremost living expert on it, and I worked with her long enough to know what to do myself.
Yes,
she hissed acidly.
Aren't we lucky?
We are, when you think about it, I said, trying to sound nonchalant and matter-of-fact and reasonable. I don't think I was selling it. I noticed my voice was a little higher and squeakier than normal. Of all the magi who could have come here, one of the top experts in her specialty landed in our laps just when we needed her the most. No one knows better how to generate and manipulate that kind of power. With her expertise there to support us, The rest of the group can deal with weaving the power to activate and control the portal.
I just can't understand why you can't do that part, she complained.
Why can't she slut around with one of the other guys? I know for a fact that she has slept with at least four of them.
Because I was her study partner for 3 years, and not just a casual liaison. There's a big difference when you have two magi who know what they're doing, instead of one and a willing subject. And to be honest, we were a great team. No other partner has ever been able to raise as much power or with such control as I did, she said. I said proudly,
I bet she did. You men will believe anything.
She knows me, how I act and react, how to wheedle every last nuance of energy from a run, I said weakly. And I know her. Together we can build significantly more power and of the right kind than any two other magi present. And, if I do say so myself, we can keep it up as long as we need to.
I'm sure you can, she said icily.
You all say that sort of thing.
She stared at me for a moment then and sighed, her mask of the scorned woman crumbling to reveal for a moment the image of a scared young girl.
Look. Are you sure there is no other way?
If there was, I would have thought of it by now. Hells, I'm not even guaranteeing that this will work. It's just our best chance of any of us getting out of here alive. We can't even send for more help through the other world. Whatever else we tried, the barrier that the old god has put up around us would keep it from working. For the last few days, we had all become aware of a kind of arcane bubble, stronger than regular wardings, that had intercepted every attempt we'd made to even scry beyond the valley, and we had all noted that it was only growing in strength. But the Molopar portal works, theoretically, in proportion to the proximity of the mage, and right now we are closer to it than he is. In 3 or 4 more days, though, it won't matter. He will be close enough to kill us 1,000 other horrible ways, probably by ritual sacrifice, to fuel spells to use the portal himself. Alia was quiet for a long time, looking at her hands.
So you really do need to nail your old girlfriend to save us?
It was my turn to sigh. I promise I won't enjoy it, okay? It will just be work. I'll be thinking of you the whole time, I added, with a little desperation.
Look, my love, we need to do this. We really do. It's our only possible means of escape, for all of us. If it even works.
I'm sorry if you are upset by it, and I can't really blame you for that, but it needs to be done whether you like it or not. I don't expect you to stand next to us and cheer us on, but I had hoped that you would trust me enough to know that I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have to. I just wish you would understand. Her eyes flashed.
I guess it's just too much for a poor little ignorant peasant girl like me to understand. You've already taken over the castle. I hear QC is confined to his chambers. And so I guess pushing aside some country wench that was warming your bed is pretty small game in the scheme of things.
I am not pushing you aside, I said, raising my voice. I don't lust after power, and don't pull that poor little peasant girl routine on me.
I love you, Alia.
I'm awfully fond of Penny, and she's a wonderful friend and a great colleague, but I love you. This is just business. I want to spend my life with you, not her. I want you to continue to warm my bed, among other places, assuming that we don't burn out our brains in the process of doing this.
That sounds like a load of enough!
It was my turn to get a little emotive. She seemed to be purposefully exasperating.
Woman, I just pled my undying love for you, and you can't retract your claws long enough to listen to me. We are going to be dead in a week unless I do this. I've already risked my neck 1,000 times for you and your people, and only survived because it amuses some capricious god or goddess to play with my fate like a toy. Well, fine. I can put up with all that, because I found you in the bargain.
Of course, you are too busy indulging in a jealous fit to realize that I'm doing everything I can, including nailing my ex-girlfriend, to preserve what we have and what we might have together. There were tears in her eyes. She walked sullenly over to me and I prepared myself for a slap. Instead, I found her entwined in my arms.
Just don't enjoy it, all right?
she whispered through her tears. I will do my best, I promised, holding her tightly. I really wished you two liked each other. That would make all of this a lot easier.
I guess that we would have run into each other eventually. She's a part of your life. But the whole I'm an imperial noble and a mighty sorceress thing of hers really gets to me sometimes.
I had to chuckle. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Me too. She really is a nice person when you get beyond that. Remember, she grew up in a crumbly old villa, raised by servants, schooled by the best tutors, and ignored by her parents until she developed talent. She didn't have the advantages we did growing up, chasing each other with sticks, playing in the mud in the commons, making each other eat dog poop. That brought a ragged smile to her face, like a ray of sun through a thunderhead. So feel sorry for her, but don't hate her.
I'll try,
she said, sniffling. I hope you will, because you are right. She will always be a part of my life. I fully expect her to dance at my wedding.
Minelan?
Alia asked, looking me in the face. What?
Assuming we aren't dead any time soon, that may occur sooner than you planned. If you really did plan it, that is, and aren't just saying what a silly farm girl wants to hear.
What do you mean? I asked, troubled.
I think I'm pregnant. I should have bled 2 weeks ago.
That was unexpected. Are you sure? I asked, when the words managed to penetrate my whirling brain. The whole world stopped while I waited for her answer.
Hey, aren't you a spellmonger? Usually you lot can check on this kind of thing. Magic, spells, charms.
Right. Yes, it's a pretty simple spell. A mere scrying technique, really, and...
Well, quit babbling and do it! She snapped, frustrated. I've been worried about this for weeks and haven't been able to tell you. If I have to go one more day, one more hour, I think I'm going to scream.
Pregnancy would explain why she was behaving more moodily than usual. My mind did its best to focus on the practical in the face of the deeply personal news, but it was suddenly having trouble.
Yeah. Sure,
I said in a daze, fetching my sphere from its pouch on my weapons belt. She stood there expectantly, no pun intended, while I did the preliminaries. When I realized I was stalling, I went ahead and did it, before she realized I was stalling. In moments, an image of her innards entered my mind. I was pretty familiar with anatomy, particularly her anatomy, and though I wasn't adept at the type of magics worked by hedge witches and midwives, finding the swollen uterus proved easily. In mage sight, all of her body's energy centered on it. It took only a little more probing, a slight focus to my attention. And there it was, a tiny worm-like grub that would all too soon be the size of a standard-issue baby.
Ah, I said eloquently, what does that mean? Professionally speaking,
she asked wryly. I said again, you are really, definitely pregnant.
With your child,
she added.
Apparently,
I said, my world spinning around me.
If you have doubts as to the paternity, I invite you to investigate them,
she said icily.
But whatever the princess says about me to the contrary, I haven't been with anyone but you since my husband died. The little bastard is yours.
You sound pretty happy about it, I commented, stone-faced.
I am. I wanted a child so badly. When my husband died, I never thought I'd get another chance, until I met you. But I can see by the look on your face that this is not automatically a happy thing for you. Look, if this is a problem, then I can go my own way. Assuming that we live to the next full moon, that is. No. No, that isn't what I meant. I'm just stunned. And confused. And a daddy.
Yeah. That's the part that is stunning and confusing me.
Trigg's toenails. Why didn't you tell me sooner? I didn't want to distract you from your work, so I didn't even mention the possibility before. But I vomited twice since yesterday, and I can suddenly smell like a bloodhound. This morning I broke down into tears for no good reason, so it seemed like a good time to bring it up.
I'm glad you did, I said, not really even hearing my own words.
My entire personal universe had just altered significantly. Everything, from my recent usurpation of power to my long-shot scheme for rescuing us to my relationships with both Alia and Penny, was in flux. All of that shifted in perspective. Evil Dark Lords and Goblin Hordes and magic portals and traitorous wizards all faded into unimportance as the weight of the idea started to bear on me. I suppose every man, when confronted with this situation, finds himself at a crossroad, where one way leads towards acceptance, where you embrace the idea of fatherhood. The other way also beckons, that almost irresistible urge to put as many leagues between you and the mother and the lifelong responsibility as possible. And then, like a legal case, you are shown evidence for making that decision by the law brother of your conscience. Perhaps it is a judge of your deepest character. Perhaps it is a primitive reaction to an inherent biological condition. But every man, no matter how much he thinks he knows the answer before the question is asked, I think, has to go to the deepest corner of his soul to make that choice. Interestingly enough, my arguments against embracing the pregnancy were mostly based on the normally sane fear of the unknown. I really truly loved Alia. There was no doubt in my mind, based on my short but intense acquaintance with her, that she would be a superlative mother to any child. What would this do to our relationship? Pregnancy and motherhood change a woman. They also change a man. My own role as a father I doubted more. After all, who was I to be a father? I felt as if I had only recently stopped being a child myself. Mostly. Maybe. What decided the matter, actually, was the briefest flash of memory from my own childhood. I must have been about 2, maybe a little older, sitting in the kitchen with Mama and getting in the way of her skinning some river tubers that I never liked. My youngest sister was also there, maybe helping a little more than she was destroying. Suddenly the door to the bakery burst open, and my father was standing there, covered from head to toe with flour. He had wetted it into his hair, spiking it up in a grotesque mockery of horns, and twirled his beard into little flowery ringlets like a white-grey thorn bush. In retrospect, there may have been spirits on his breath. It took me a frightened moment to realize that it was Dad, and when I did, I still squealed. His eyes wide and maniacal, he began chasing me around the kitchen, making growly noises every time I screamed. My heart raced, my eyes were whirling, and I was enraptured, but not nearly as much as he. I remembered this moment vividly. I could smell the bread baking, the fresh, green smell of the tubers, the taste of the flour in the air, and I saw the ecstatic look on my father's face as he played Flower Monster with his only son. And then, for a frozen instant, I saw my face under the flour instead of Dad's. I saw the same expression, same look of enchantment in my eyes. I could imagine, perhaps, what it was like to chase a 2-year-old around, and then tickling them to death while your wife looks on with a smile warm enough to proof dough. I took the road that I hoped led to that. Alia's news had not stopped the world nearly as long as I would have liked it to. Around us, the castle bustled with people going about under my orders. While it was true that I had officially confined Kusi to his quarters, the rumor that I was going to have him executed the following dawn was not. Indeed, once he was made to realize that our position was untenable, and that I had a better alternative than fighting bravely to the last man, he had become very cooperative. While he was in his quarters, a stream of messengers ran to and fro, conveying his bidding to his men. He had given his unconditional parole, agreed to cooperate fully, and to be honest, I think he was happy to be relieved of the responsibility of overall command of the castle. The little rat, Garkescu, on the other hand, was nowhere to be found. Not that we looked too hard. His remaining apprentice started haunting my quarters, and I kind of adopted Rondal as a result. He proved to be truly helpful, even if there was some friction between him and Tyndall. There was plenty of work for 2 apprentices, though, so that kept them from getting into fights. Everyone else was as busy. If we were going to pull this off without disaster striking, there was a lot we had to do. I had 3 dozen peasant women stuffing and sewing a pile of cast-off clothes into a small army of dummies, which began filling up the guard positions on the battlements. A few of the younger war magi were giving them slight magical dwemers to make them seem alive, at least to casual scrying. I put the castellan, good old grumpy Sir Kay, to work judging which personal items would be approved for travel through the portal. That caused a lot of squawking, especially among the peasants, some of whom thought of chickens and piglets as irreplaceable goods. Sir Kay was perfect for the job. It took a fanatic to argue with the man once his mind was set. Only a dozen or so cases would appeal to my judgment, and with 2 exceptions, I backed the crusty castellan's ruling. The mercenaries were also grumbling over leaving behind horses and weapons that they had grown fond of. I gave them a little more leeway, but was still strict. I, myself, was not happy with the prospect of leaving Traveller here to become the main course at a Gervani luncheon, but as much as I loved that Rouncey, he was still just a horse. The Crinroc, too, were unruly about abandoning their possessions, though they were more pragmatic than the Bovali peasantry. They left their wagons and livestock, but were defiantly unwilling to leave behind about 200 2-foot-tall totem statues that had some religious significance. In the end, I acquiesced. They weren't willing to leave them behind, and I wasn't about to leave the Crinroc behind. Preparation for departure was just part of the plan. I continued the routine terror raids by the war magi against the Gervani for a couple of good reasons. While the remaining shamans had tightened up their operations and security, they were ultimately unable to stop my men from pillaging another 4 or 5 more witchstones. When that produced a couple of haphazard assaults on the gates in response by overeager goblins, I even allowed 2 brief sorties by the regular cavalry, a kind of last glorious run with their steeds before we left. But going after witchstones was only part of the plan. Each war magi raid left a trail of destruction in its wake, and provided enough distractions so that my sabotage teams of war magi were able to complete their own clandestine missions. These were designed to mess up goblin communications and logistics as much as possible. While we didn't have a chance against the old god, there was no reason to leave his forces unmolested before he showed up. And that factor was foremost on everyone's minds. The overbearing presence of the old god on the horizon could be felt by nearly everyone with a shred of magical sensitivity. We could see past the mountains a few miles, to the extent his barrier allowed. But westward, there was a shimmering in the air over the peaks, the kind of distortion you get when there's a lot of ambient magic in the air. It became especially florid at dusk. So did the sense of oppressiveness. There was no denying that every dusk was worse than the previous one. While the approach of impending doom did little for morale, it kept everyone extremely motivated about his or her tasks. No one wanted to be here when he arrived. Meanwhile, I stayed in conference with the team I had chosen to help us open the portal, direct it, and keep it open. We continued to meet in the cave itself, usually with Gurkhal helpfully providing translation of some of the Gervani texts that discussed the matter. He had been a model prisoner, almost one of the team, once we'd allowed him access. He was certainly no longer Sharul's creature. He was almost smug about it. Since he had seen and dwelled in the sacred cave, he had seemed to transcend the pettiness of the old god's rampage, readily helping us with our plans as the best way to accomplish the goal of cleaning the valley of all Humani influences. The others were wary of including an admitted foe into the midst of our most secret councils, but I invited any of them to find a single spell on him that tied the Gervan to his former leaders. Besides, his gruff voice and odd accent concealed an offbeat sense of humor to our discussions that kept things cordial under tense circumstances. The core team stood at 7, excluding Gurkhal. Penny and myself would be the energy providers. Carmella was the transformer, controller of the various apis that we would need in the course of this spell. Really a director of power and monitor of our physical bodies. Talaman helped design the specifics and would act as a backup to Carmella or Delman or Taran if needed. Delman would direct our energy out to the other magi, who would then spin it up to reality-altering levels, before shooting it back through Raylan, who would act as a converter, taking all of that raw power and building it into a coherent wave. Then there was Taran, a mage not too much older than me, with whom I had studied briefly at the academy. While trained as a war mage, Taran had been one of the few who had been so gifted that he was selected for advanced study at the war college instead of normal duty. He missed the Frisian campaign entirely, electing instead to pursue his studies without being shot at. I don't remember being given a choice, but maybe I'm just not that good. Taran would be our focus. He had spent the longest time at Inarian Academy, and that's where we were trying to go. That might sound like an unusual choice of destination, but it made sense in a lot of ways. First, it was a place that most of us were familiar with. Many of us had gone to school there, so we knew it like a farmer knows his chicken coop. There was a lot of residual magic there, some going back to the Majocracy, which theoretically made it a bigger target for Taran to latch onto. While the distance was far greater than, say, one of the larger cities in Alshar, we couldn't really decide if distance had anything to do with it. I was pretty sure it didn't. Taran had suggested attempting to anchor the other end of the portal, assuming we could activate it, to an old and crumbling memorial archway in one of the courtyards of the academy. It dated from imperial times. Some benefactor of the school no doubt had it built to celebrate the glory of the Majocracy, or some crap like that. No one knew for certain. But it was there, made a good theoretical anchor point, and should be mostly deserted. Taran said he found it a perfect place to study, and I fondly recalled one rare and memorable assignation I had there with one of the local girls from Tower Town at Midsummer. I never saw her again, and don't really remember her name, but I'll never forget that night. Others had similar memories to help reinforce the target, so we aimed for the academy. It didn't take long to decide the most basic issues, like who did what. We played to our strengths as magi. The problems came in executing such an intricate spell. Imperial training covered the basics for what we were doing, but no one had tried anything like this, with Irianite, no less, since the Majocracy fell. Not to my knowledge. We were improvising, making some pretty large assumptions, and hoping and praying a lot. And cursing. Not really textbook standard thaumaturgy. It took almost 6 hours just to hammer out the particulars for the spell. We did 2 rehearsals, using minor cantrips to stand for the more serious power we would generate, and made certain everyone knew their part. There was the usual grandstanding and juvenile complaining that you get any time you try to get more than 3 people to do 1 thing at a time. But then again, these were highly motivated professionals with their own lives on the line. The tangible sense of doom that was only a day or 2 away at most gave us a sense of urgency to get this right. We would not have a second chance. The hour of departure was set for dawn the next day. Not that you could really see the sun anymore. Sherul had darkened the sky, making Bovol Castle a goblin playground all day and all night. I awoke long before dawn the next morning with my face pressed into Alia's sweet-smelling hair. I restrained the impulse to make love to her one last time. As sweet as it would have been, it would have depleted me of my vitality prematurely. I settled for holding her and smelling her hair until I could brook no more delay. "You remember what I said?"
"Yes, my lord,"
she said sarcastically as she pulled her shift on over her head. She'd taken to calling me that since I'd usurped Sire Kusi and conquered the domain.
"Take your baggage through to the academy grounds. Find some old codger named Master Hesklestai, and give him your letter and journal. Then tell my story to the authorities, whoever they are. Wait for word from you for 3 fortnights. Then take the small fortune you have given me and use it to get to your parents' house with Tyndall, along with the depressing note about how you are dead, so that they can take care of me and your unborn bastard."
"A little dramatic," I concluded, "but essentially correct. Tell my folks that I love them."
"You tell them yourself," she said, sliding up next to me for a last hug and kiss. "Now get down there and screw your ex-girlfriend for the good of the people."
"Alia," I groaned. "I thought you were past this."
"No, seriously. Give her an inch from me,"
she said, swatting me on the butt. Ring her bell hard, and a lot.
I'll never understand her, or any woman, but particularly her. Perhaps that's why I had fallen so hard for her, and why leaving her standing there, pregnant and packing, was high on the list of the most difficult things I have ever had to do in my life. I made my way down into the cave and tried not to think about what I was going to do, else my doubts about our success would undermine the attempt. Once I got there, most of the others were already standing around, drinking hot cups of sweet mulled wine. The bastards had raided what was left of Kusi's cellar and been holding out on me, and taking the herbs they would need to sustain them through the spell. Penny had our little pharmacopium laid out on one of the old altars for me to inspect before she dosed me. No less than 6 different powders and herbs prepared in various ways. 3 of them I knew. The other 3 I took without comment. Penny knows her stuff, and I trusted in that. While I waited for the drugs to take effect, I wandered around and talked to each member of each team, joking, laughing nervously, and double-checking that everything was prepared. That was as much for their benefit as my own, I guess. They had formed as tight-knit a team as I could ask for in this last week, aided, of course, by the potent power of the Witchstones and the fear of imminent doom. They were a good team, young, skilled, ambitious. When I had done all the reassuring I was capable of, I wandered over to the Molopar, soon-to-be portal, and stared at it for a while. Could we do this? Really? There was no doubt that it had been done in the past. The Gavani records Gurkhal had translated were certain on that point. The horrors of the Goblin Wars, the strange beasts that were not native to this world, had arisen from someplace, and this looked like the place. But could we do this? This was high magic, on an order that hadn't been attempted in centuries. I was proud and confident in my crew. I've never worked with better magi. But would the rest of the universe cooperate? The questions haunted my mind. Could we activate this thing, direct it, and keep it open long enough for everyone to get out? Would I have enough strength? My future wife and child depended upon it. Did I have enough resolve to save them, and everyone else? I had to. I would will them away on my own, if I could. Did I suddenly have a screaming erection so hard it could break rock? Apparently I did, I noticed as I looked down. All right, everyone, I called. Get to your places. Goodman Pokey Poke says it's showtime. Penny stretched out on the round cushion we had created as our staging area, and staging, I realized suddenly, was indeed the proper term. I was used to performing for Penny. I was not used to a well-informed and highly critical audience watching my every move, mundane and mystical. Don't get me wrong, I'm hardly shy. About sex, that is. But this was different. The group would not just see my lusty performance, but they would also see the complex interplay of magic that would arise from it. The interesting part. I was more worried about their thaumaturgical criticism about that than I was my ability to physically perform. Besides, whatever Penny gave me had me stiff as iron. I couldn't wimp out of this if I tried. But because of the way things were set up, if all went well, then every single one of the refugees using the portal would end up seeing me too. Literally, thousands of people. That was a level of exposure I had never had to contend with. Penny leaned forward as I was shrugging off my robe and gave me a quick peck on the cheek, the only kiss we shared. This wasn't about romance. This was business.
For luck, she said, settling back.
Luck is for cowards, I said with mock bravery. We real men.
Yeah, yeah, mister. I've heard it all before. Let's get on with it.
I appreciated her businesslike and professional demeanor. I tried to ignore her trembling. We started out in the first of the 5 classic positions, with me on top. This is best for starting a brisk rise of power. I was handling the apis for the 2 of us. The concentration required is helpful for maintaining a consistent state of arousal over a long period of time, and first position is the easiest one to hold an apis in. The plan was for us to go through all 5, then repeat.
I clasped my Erionite sphere in my left palm, and felt Penny do the same to hers in her right hand. And the moment we began to raise power, the two were linked. I felt it run through me like a shiver, coalesce around the sphere, then jump over to Penny's shard. I felt a reciprocal jolt from hers, and I welcomed it into me to mix with my own. All of this was more or less textbook, though textbooks on sex magic are rare, except that the power levels we were playing with were rising far faster than I had anticipated. Before we knew it, our personal reservoirs were filled, and it was time to begin the operation in earnest. It was unexpectedly intoxicating, like discovering too late that someone has poured triple distilled spirits into your wine glass unexpectedly. The connection between our two stones was even more intimate than the one at our loins. I could feel Penny's thoughts and emotions through the stone, without going through the medium of the other world at all. The proximity of the Molopar was not hurting, of course. I could sneeze down here and cast better spells by accident than an Eastern adept could do in hours any place else. I had the barest moment of panic that the power would be too much, but the confident look in Penny's eyes banished it instantly. I was far more confident in her abilities than my own. "Prepare, Delmon," I called, though I never took my eyes from Penny's. Eye contact is very important in such a working. It facilitates communication at levels that even magic can't reach, and it gives you something to stare at. And Penny had pretty grey eyes. When I heard Delmon's assent, I silently questioned Penny about who should do the honors, and with the barest nod, she let me take control. It was like pair dancing. Someone has to lead. I shifted my weight slightly, shifted my focus minutely, and suddenly the reservoir of magic poured out of our combined bodies and minds, through the Apis and over to Delmon, who used his own stone to parcel it up and hand it off to the others. It was a strain, I know. I was feeling it myself. But Delmon was good in groups, and after the first couple of sloppy handoffs he got more efficient. We got faster. The power began to flow in earnest. After that, time just kind of stopped for me. I was anxious, of course, but I knew my anxiety wouldn't help matters, so I concentrated on the task at hand. It was after our first position change that I heard Delmon call out, "Here it comes, Raymon!" And I felt a slight shift in the power flow. I could also feel Raymon struggle with the first few transfers, but he straightened out quickly and began building his spell wave. I continued to focus, feeling almost overwhelmed at the amount of power we were handling. It is indescribable, as if every cell in your body is singing at once. I saw those feelings reflected back at me in Penny's eyes, and we both added a little extra capacity with our enthusiasm for the chore, like two little kids who found the sugar bowl unattended. In this type of magic, the power is built on the male side by postponing orgasm, while encouraging empowerment, while on the female side, the power comes in sharp waves, tied to the duration and frequency of orgasm. Every time Penny had a happy moment, there would be a resulting spike in power that was my job to complement. "Keep it going, friends," called out Carmella, who was doing an excellent job of monitoring. "Just one more link and we'll be there, I think." That was fine by me. My arm was getting tired. We were about to shift into position three, when Raymon finally called out, "I'm just about there. Get ready, Taran." Our final mage in the working nodded curtly, and suddenly there was a sustained magical flash between Raymon and Taran as their witch stones leapt to life. Taran was stationed in front of the portal, which he had been studying non-stop since he found out about it. He was a brilliant thaumaturge, after all, and he did not move a muscle that I could tell. He stood there, stone in front of his face, and waved his right hand as he plumbed the depths of the Molopar. He had tried explaining his theory to me, but it was based on precepts that were in advance of what I knew, and I was therefore lost very quickly. At least he had a theory. I had no idea how I would try to unlock the thing. He must have been doing something right, though, because shortly the disk started to cloud in, a thick grey murky cover over the naked stone underneath. I saw glints of shapes and colours wade through it, and I found it fascinating to watch. Too fascinating.
Penny slapped my face, hard.
Focus!
I grunted, and focused. She was quite right, of course. I had my job to do. Taran had his. There was no time for professional oversight, not when a moment's faltering could send the entire working into the chamber pot. I got back to business and redoubled my efforts. It took far longer than I would have liked, and I won't lie and say I wasn't worried for a bit, but Taran eventually shouted, "I've got something!" Then, a moment later, "I have it! I see the arch! I see the arch!" While we were all too professional to burst out in cheers or applause, which would have been counterproductive, if not disastrous, I could definitely feel the shift in attitude around the room toward hopeful optimism. One of the mercenaries who had volunteered for the assignment took a breath, made a sign with his hands, and then walked through. In seconds, he stepped back through and was shouting excitedly, "It worked! I saw people! It worked!" I could tell it worked too. There was suddenly a warm breeze on my backside, and the smell of fresh grass, rather than moldy cave. A few seconds later, I heard the bell tower in the commons sound the afternoon call to chores. We had done it. We had taken an ancient piece of alien magic and made it do our bidding. We had threaded the grommet in the fabric of reality, with my root acting metaphorically as a needle. Something this powerful hadn't been done by humans since the inundation, if then. I really wish our spectators would have been more impressed with the subtleties of the working, but I guess ignorance is the layman's privilege. Pentandra and I altered our work then, concentrating more on maintaining and sustaining the reaction, and not building more power. This was easier for me than Penny in theory, as women have a natural inclination to increase the level of their climaxes. But then again, when it came to sex magic, Penny could screw circles around me. As she regulated her climaxes, I finally broke eye contact with her. In position three, this is pretty easy to do, and closed my eyes, fine-tuning the stream. I almost didn't notice the busy parade past the bedstead. The refugees were starting to file past, their arms full of their valuables or their children. I didn't see them, of course, but I could smell them, hear them, and feel their terror as they walked into a hole that wasn't there a few moments ago. They were being herded by the castle's men-at-arms, and overseen by Sir Kay. Time tromped by like the feet of 1,000 peasants, which were also tromping by, but I kept going. Twice Carmella came by and offered Penny and me water, for which we were grateful. Dehydration is one of the inherent dangers in sex magic, as the participants are often too distracted by the work to care about such things. But not too much. Interrupting a spell because you need to find a chamber pot is amateurish and unprofessional, not to mention unproductive. One by one they hurried through the portal. I didn't even try to keep count, although Sir Kay would shout a number out every now and then. I tried to ignore it and concentrate on doing what I was doing indefinitely. Toward the end it was Alia's turn in line, and she broke step just long enough to kiss me on the ear before she was safely through. I thought Penny would have a hissy fit about letting a commoner distract me at such a crucial moment, but when I ventured a worried glance in her direction, I was pleasantly surprised to see a warm, almost loving smile on her face. Heartened that my personal life may not be a total disaster after all, I focused my efforts and gave her a little extra for a few minutes. We were almost ready to switch out of position four when Tyndall came by bearing a huge pack, trailed by Rondal with a similar one. Tyndall knew better than to interrupt me, but he drew his wand and saluted bravely before he left. Somehow I don't think Penny would have been as tolerant should he have kissed me like Alia did. I'm not sure I would have been either, come to think of it. I should have realized that the line was almost through, as Tyndall was definitely at the tail end of it. Gokal was behind him, technically in Tyndall's custody, our one prisoner of war. The rest of the Bovali followed, until all of the civilians were through. Then it was the garrison's turn. One by one the guards and sentries were pulled from their posts and replaced with the slightly enchanted dummies we'd prepared. From a distance, they should fool casual observation, as they would appear to move in small ways, shift weight, scratch their nose, rub their eyes. And to improve the effect, we had several fires lit in the kitchens and the bailey.
From the front lines and the scrying pools of the Gavani besiegers, it should look, more or less, like we were all still here awaiting slaughter. Finally, Carmella called out,
"Sir Kay just went through, ladies and gentlemen. We have officially rescued everyone. Over 4,000 people just saw your hairy, naked ass and Penny's boobs, men."
I felt elated. So did everyone else. And I wasn't tired at all. Ishi's tits. I was just getting started. Which was good, because this was the part of the plan that was problematic. You see, it took a dozen of us concentrating intently to keep the portal open. It wouldn't stay open unless we kept at our tasks, so there was no way we could follow them through the monopar. That fact had caused a lot of discussion. As brave and public-spirited as my team was, none of us wanted to volunteer for a suicide mission, especially since we just got ourselves a horde of Irionite. So when the gate vanished, that left us with very few options. We had discussed it far into the night, and the result was our second phase plan, cutting our way out of the valley. While 1,000 people may have a hard time sneaking past 250,000 goblins, 20-odd, highly trained and newly augmented war magi shouldn't have near as much trouble. Oh, it would be difficult, no doubt. Some of us would likely die in the attempt, but we were counting a number of factors in our favor, and this was one of them. After we let the gate collapse, we still had a full circle crackling with power to play with. Penny and I kept at it, but Delman and the others shifted the focus of the spell and its intention. I had had the diorama we built of the castle brought down from my tower, and the moment the gate was gone, several magi converged on it and started throwing around a lot of spells through it. Most were simply nasty war spells, the type we had been using so liberally on the goblins in the last few weeks. Those were designed to put fear and discomfort into the enemy camp, which is always fun. Others were longer term, subtle spells that would be difficult to detect and remove, but would make life in Bovol Castle less than pleasant for the new owners. Still others were specifically designed to cut a weak spot in our enemy's defenses, something devastating enough that we could exploit it to escape the immediate siege and cut out across the valley, like Korbal was chasing us, which wasn't far from the truth. The mythical demon god of the Mindens was mythical, and Sherul, the great ghost, was not. After rescuing everyone else, the Magi seemed almost relieved to have this opportunity. The team was like a bunch of teenagers settling down to their first dice game. It was the most fun they had ever had professionally. Being able to use war magic spells without having to consider civilian casualties allowed the most talented of them to try out the truly outrageous spells that had always been interesting theory around the campfire, but were seen as impractical in reality. Now they had a unique opportunity to experiment with the theory. Chains of explosions erupted from every fire. Distractions and annoyances, like dancing lights and foul odors, hid truly lethal spells. Waves of terror and despair would be rocking the enemy camp. Giants, made out of smoke, uttering horrible curses, emerged from the castle and spread terror. Their supplies would rot, bundles of firewood would spontaneously ignite, and water supplies would spring leaks. Whole encampments would suddenly faint, or vomit, or have amnesia. Fleas, molds, and fungus multiplied at an increased rate. Sandstorms of pebbles, wild animals, sudden bursts of lightning and thunder, rusty weapons and rotting leather, gouts of green fire jumping from soldier to soldier. We spared no indignity, no injury, no ingenuity to trouble the Gavani. Of course, this also let the enemy know that something unusual was happening inside Bovol Castle. While we were running the Molopar portal, all of our power was directed within. Now everyone in the valley, with the magical sensitivity of a rabbit, would know that we were throwing our mystical weight around. It would only be a matter of time before the enemy would feel compelled to act. "All right, happy couple, time for the big finish," Delmon called with a grin. "If you two have had enough now, you can do what you need to. A big burst would actually help, so ramp it up all you can."
"Position two?" I asked with a grin. "Just what I was thinking. Want a pillow?"
I won't bore you with the details, which would be of interest only to the aficionado and the vulgar. Suffice it to say that in another 5 minutes, we culminated at a masterful peak, dwarfing the amount of energy that we had produced before. Then I finally climaxed. It was indescribable. It sent shockwaves through the net of spells and enchantments they'd cast, and for a few moments I was in a storm of mental confusion and fuzzy feelings, all tinged with the green amber. I think we both went unconscious for a while, because the next coherent moment I remember was Carmella shaking me awake, a worried expression on her face.
"Minovan?"
she said, more of a statement than a question.
"Come on, boy! Wake up! It's over! It's over! Minolin?"
The pale green magical glow that had permeated my mind softly faded, and reality reasserted itself. Penny lay next to me, a dreamy, unearthly expression of absolute bliss on her face. I could still feel the hum of every cell in her body, hear their quiet whisper as they went about their metabolic business. She still blazed by mage sight, and I had little doubt that we both stood out like a beacon in the other world. She rolled over slowly, and her unfocused eyes stared in my direction.
"Damn," she whispered, "you are good."
I smiled, just the affirmation I needed. As much as I wanted to bask in the compliment and the attendant afterglow, my brain stubbornly refused to let go of the number of crises that would have to be dealt with to affect my eventual survival. I spared one last moment for pure appreciation and awe, and then sat up.
"I need some food and some water. Soon," I said,
swinging my shaky legs over the side of the makeshift bed. Penny groaned and turned over.
"Just like a damn man," she muttered. "I need a towel and a basin."
Carmella sighed and put a water skin into my hands. While I drank, she fished a sausage and a hunk of Beauval cheese out of a hamper.
"Take it easy," she said gently. "You were out for at least 5 minutes. The mountain folk are still reacting to our mayhem, so we probably have a little while." "Every second is precious," I grimaced, "and everything I've got is suddenly sore. Is everything ready?"
"As ready as it's going to get," Delman called. "There is a 50-foot-high wall of magical green flame around the castle, and the Scruggs seem to be keeping their distance for now. I think they're distracted by what we threw at them. Every now and then someone will shoot an arrow at the barrier, but that's about it. No assault parties, no siege towers, just screams of defiance. They have their own problems right now," he grinned.
"Not for long," I countered.
As much as my body wanted me to relax, as much as I wanted to enjoy the brief respite before an attack began in earnest, as much as I ached and parts of me were chafed, my soldier's instinct was telling me it was time for action.
"Get dressed,"
I said to Penny, who was curled up in a delicious-looking fetal position.
"It's time to go." "Just leave the money on the dresser," she said dreamily. "I'm going to take a bubble bath."
"Woman," I warned, "playtime is over."
"Oh, you are so frustrating."
She struggled half-heartedly into her robe. I stood and reached for my own clothes.
"Just like a damn man,"
she muttered. 15 minutes later, we were gathering in the inner bailey, checking our packs, and leaving a few last-minute surprises for our friends the goblins before we moved out. There was, indeed, a green wall of flame that blocked out the horizon in all directions around the castle. It was impressive. I was saddling up Traveller. The revised plan had included a speedy retreat, and I was overjoyed that we wouldn't be parted yet, when I felt a presence and heard a voice I wasn't prepared to.
"My congratulations, Master Minolin," said the quiet, tired voice of Sire Cousy from behind me. "You have saved my people. A small victory, but one I am pleased to have witnessed."
I jumped, still a little shaky from the ritual.
"Sire?"
The old man stood there in his full armor, helmet on and visor raised. He looked worn and tired and resigned, somehow.
"Sir, not sire. Since you conquered my domain," he offered. "Just a landless knight now."
"Sire, why didn't you go with them? Why didn't you escape? I mean, you can come with us. I shall not abandon the land my ancestors fought for," he declared softly. "While the honor of my house may be questioned, my personal honor is my own responsibility. I shall stay and be the last defender of my lands." I started to call him a fool, and then realized that choosing death with honor was the knight's only chivalrous way out of the situation. Should he return to the Five Duchies as a refugee lord, a knight without lands and folk, he would be at best a laughingstock and an outcast, and at worst an ignoble mercenary condemned to die in unchivalrous obscurity. This way, his brother could, in theory, continue the title and the family line without the blemish of dishonor on the house. But while his brother was carried through the portal on a stretcher, raving with fever, I didn't really expect him to survive much longer. His body had been through too much. Sire Kusi probably was going to be the last living scion of the House Brandmount. Nobility works in weird ways. Instead of rebuking him, I drew my mage blade and saluted him. He bowed in return, a slight smile on his face. I also want to thank you for doing what you did. I acted on the advice of poor counsel, I see now. Had I listened to Garkesko, we both knew what would have happened. I nodded. Where is the little weasel anyway? Did he escape with the others? No one saw him go through the portal, but he may well have gone in disguise to avoid your wrath. That would be congruent with his character. Somehow I can't imagine that he'd stick around here all by himself. It would serve him right if he did. If you will indulge me, my lord, we have a last bit of business, Kusi said, changing the subject without comment. We don't have much time. Here, he said, proffering a velvet sack, are the jewels of my house. Rather than let the goblins make toys of them, I bid you to take them, sell them, and make provision for my people. My brother has already taken what gold was left in my treasury, but if he does not survive, I trust you and Sir Kay to look after my folk. Included is the deed of title to Beauvoir Vale for what it is worth. According to the laws of Luin and Duin, it is rightfully yours, but if you see fit to return it to my house, perhaps it will be of use some day when all of this, he said, waving to the distraction around us, is past. But first and foremost, see to my brave Bovale, he insisted. It shall be done. You have my promise, I said, taking the sack. Here also is a parcel of some of the more interesting artifacts that we took from the caves. They may well be enchantments that will prove useful in your studies. Perhaps they will even be of use in the coming war. They might at that. The basket he handed me had all manner of odd junk in it. None of it was gold or silver, but some of it was clearly magical, and some of it was clearly not. I looked forward to peeling it apart some day when my life wasn't in mortal peril. Next, I bid you to carry this letter to the Coronet Council. After Beauvoir falls, it will not be long until the blight spreads throughout the Five Duchies. Indeed, the Wilderlands is already under assault beyond our frontiers. This is my report, and my recommendation, as well as a truthful accounting of my house's acquisition of this land. I shall deliver it. Finally, here is a letter and a token to be delivered to Count Olot, head of House Rieran, my wife's family, he explained. A last farewell is all, and the return of an heirloom from her dowry they count as precious. I shall see it done. Thank you, Master Minolin. I shall die easier knowing these things are attended to. Despite all that has happened, you are a brave warrior and a cunning wizard, and it has been a true honor to have fought next to you, both in Faris and in my home. I rested a hand on the old warrior's shoulder. Words were unnecessary. All of our acrimony was done. You had best mount, he said at last, tears in his eyes. I must see to my fate, and you to yours. I nodded and began to do just that, securing the baggage to my saddle horn, when I felt it. A rumble. The ground began moving, as if an earthquake was thinking about happening. While that isn't uncommon in the Mindens, I didn't think it was a natural event. Traveller neighed in protest at the harsh vibration, and started to stamp, and I couldn't blame him. It's disconcerting when the ground refuses to behave like it should. Uh-oh, I said sagely, and looked around.
I settled on the west for a direction to look at, because that is where the rumble originated. Above the green flames, above the peaks beyond, I could feel, more than hear, the disturbance. From the west, the direction of the old god's approach, I could see a dark cloud, blacker than any storm cloud. There was a noticeable change in its signature. Something had changed. Something knew that it was being thwarted. Something had suddenly decided to expedite its journey. The old god was coming quickly, and I could tell Sherul the great ghost was pissed. Chapter 15. The Dead God's Judgment. Everyone froze for just a moment while we figured out what was happening. Part of it was obvious, at least to me, and I wasn't the smartest one there. It was clear that the great Gavani shaman, Sherul, the one who had secretly been building an army for a century, the one who had planned and plotted the recapture of Boval Vale, the one who had been journeying through far mountain passes for weeks, now, with an entourage and an army, had suddenly left them behind and was now speeding, through the air, probably, straight toward us. Our time was up. We were trapped inside the castle while certain doom approached. Everyone froze, and then everyone moved at once,